Tonight, I'm very pleased to welcome Kim Steinhardt, who's going to discuss the conservation and legal issues surrounding California sea otters. He grew up in the Bay Area, graduated from Cal Berkeley. After Berkeley, he spent 12 years as a consultant and an advocate. He wrote some legislation for the state. Then after that time, he decided it was time to go to law school. He graduated from Santa Clara University School of Law. After law school, he went to Hewlett-Packard, spent 12 years there in their legal department, became an administrative law judge, and then was the chief counsel for that agency. He still teaches law classes on legislative advocacy, emphasizing ocean protection. He's on the board of directors of the Long Marine Lab Seymour Discovery Center at the University of California, Santa Cruz. In addition to being a keen observer and a wonderful writer, he photographs sea otters, and he presents illustrated talks, and he regularly writes on all things otter. He also leads natural and cultural history walks along the coast near his home on Monterey Bay, with a focus on ocean preservation, sea otters, and the complex relationship between humans and nature. Please join me in welcoming Kim Steinhardt.
Thanks, Jerry, and good evening. Let me get this right. Thanks for that warm welcome. I feel very much at home, and I really appreciate it. And I also appreciate all of you coming out here this evening to the aquarium on a weeknight, a summer school night. It always gives me a sense of hope for the future of the oceans when I see people coming together like this, that there actually is a future for our oceans, despite some of the challenges that we face. But tonight, I'm going to be your eco-tour guide for this photographic deep dive, if you'll pardon the expression, into the nearshore ocean waters that is the home of the California sea otter, also known as the southern sea otter. Don't let the two different names confuse you. It's one and the same subspecies. But I hope that by the time we're finished this evening, you will agree with me that sea otters are more than just another pretty face. They certainly are that. There we go. They sell themselves. I think that I also try to make the case that they represent something much more substantial in terms of our ability to understand our relationship, that relationship between humans and nature, and humans and the ocean in particular. And there are even some lessons that we can learn from the sea otter story about how we as humans try to use law to manage nature, sometimes successfully and sometimes not so much. More on that later. Now, one of the reasons that sea otters are so helpful in this understanding, they're known as a sentinel species or an indicator species, because what happens to sea otters tells us a lot or indicates a lot about what's going on, what's the health of that nearshore ocean water in which they live. And in fact, what happens to sea otters, like the canary in the coal mine, can often foreshadow what's going to happen or what might happen to humans. So if for no other reason sort of than selfishly to protect our own species, we need to be paying attention to sea otters and the ocean. Turns out the threats that they face and the threats that we face are largely one and the same. So we haven't always been kind to those oceans of the world, and we're kind of in a recovery period after several hundred years of poor practices, some abuse and neglect and exploitation, things that have put us a little bit in a one-down situation. The good news is that we're beginning to, I think, make the decisions that we need to make and take the actions that we need to take to try to help restore and rehabilitate and then preserve and protect these incredibly important resources, including all the creatures that live within them and even a few creatures like us who don't live in them but are fully dependent upon the ocean. Now, I have a confession to make. Jerry doesn't know this. I have a confession to make tonight. I'm actually here at the aquarium as an invasive species, something of a non-native plant, a fish out of water, and not just because I'm from Northern California. I understand that may be an issue here. But I'm not a marine biologist, and I'm not a marine scientist. I'm not a researcher. I am, as you heard, a former administrative law judge. So I come at this from the point of view of having been a litigator and a lawyer and an advocate by profession. So I look at the sea otter story through a slightly more legal lens than others might. And there is a legal side to the story, which is largely unreported. I'm going to try to change that tonight. The legal side of the story is actually beginning to loom larger and larger as a possible threat to the species. There are a couple of lawsuits out there that, if successful, would actually have a devastating impact on the otter's ability to expand to their historic range and thereby recapture the numbers they need to have in order to survive. It may surprise you to know that there are only about 3,000 sea otters left along the coast of California. Only about 3,000 sea otters left. So despite some of the successes in recovery, that's still a dangerously small number. And we really have a long way to go. They're protected under the Endangered Species Act, and they're nowhere near the level that they need to be at sustainably to survive as a species. I also look, though, at this story through something other than the legal lens, and that's the camera lens, the more traditional lens, and that accounts for this little guy who's staring at you, and all the other photos that I want to share with you this evening. I've been taking pictures, or trying to take a picture of a sea otter since I was a teenager, in the ancient days of film. Some of you may remember those days. Some of you weren't even born, I think, then. But I'm a big believer in the idea that every picture tells a story. A picture is worth 1,000 words, so to the extent I can, I will use pictures to try to illustrate the story tonight. Also because I like to share them because the otters are so darn cute. When I say every picture tells a story, let me give you a simple example. This is a picture that I might caption, adult male sea otter praying and giving thanks to the gods of the sun for the warmth of the day. But seriously, what's up with the paws? What is going on in this picture? And we know that sea otters have that very rich and luxurious coat of fur, and that's their protection against the freezing cold ocean waters. They don't have blubber, so they're not like all the other marine mammals, the whales, the dolphins, the sea lions, seals. They all have blubber. Otters just have the fur. And so it's been kind of a blessing that's kept them alive in the ocean, and at the same time, it's been a curse because it is what has attracted them. It's attracted humans to them and led to their near extinction. Well, there's one place on a sea otter's body that doesn't have any fur, and that's the palms of its forepaws. So what this otter is doing is he's pressing his palms together to try to maintain the heat and keep it in so it doesn't escape through the unprotected part of his body. He's thermoregulating. It's just like we might do in a snowy day if you didn't have any gloves on, you might actually put your palms together, right? So in this one picture, I see the embodiment of the sea otter's physiology and its struggle with the freezing cold waters, its conflict with human beings, and the question over its survival. That's what I see in this picture. What do you see? Because there is one thing that's better in some ways than a still image, and that's the video, because I can bring the sound and the motion into the room. So I want to do that early here to get these otters in the room. And this is a mom and a pup. She's eating a mussel. She's also got her arm around the pup. Doesn't want to lose him. She's got to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time here. But as she finishes it, she's actually going to have to make another dive to get some more food. And so she's going to drag him so he doesn't run away. She's very deliberate about where she's going to make that next dive. So she brings him over there. And when she gets there, she's going to have to make sure that there are no threats in the immediate vicinity, because she will be abandoning him for just a second. She's going to do a little periscope search, and down she goes. His world has now fallen apart. Mom is gone forever. He's a little anxious. But the world is right. She's come back up, and everything is good again. Now, no matter how many times she's done this, and it has been thousands of times in his early life, he's going to squawk every single time she dives. What I need to do now is lay a little foundation so that I can tell you about those lawsuits. And so I need to talk about a little more on about the characteristics of the sea otter that have put them in the crosshairs of human beings for the last 300 years or so. And I also need to talk a little bit about the fur trade, because unless we understand what happened to them, where they were, where they are, and where they're going to be, then we're not going to be able to make much sense out of the policies for long-term survival, right, for the future. So, ready for Otter Basics? Scientific name for the creature we're talking about tonight is Enhydrolutris nereus, and that means southern sea otter. There is also a northern sea otter, also called the Alaskan sea otter. There is another subspecies, and that's the Asian or Russian sea otter. So there are three subspecies. We're sticking with the southern sea otter tonight. This pup is only about 4 days old, and you can see how carefully she's cradling her cargo here in the water. Right? Sea otters are part of the Mustelidae family, which is the weasel family. And so here's a weasel, in case you haven't seen one recently. There are some other members of the family you might be familiar with. Right? In that weasel family, we have the badgers, wolverines, river otters, the tigra, the mink, and also a creature called the sea mink. There's a sea mink. That's not a photograph, that's a sketch. And that's because sea minks were hunted to extinction in the 1800s for their fur in the Atlantic Ocean. So it's actually happened to one member of this family that we've lost it to, you know, human intervention and exploitation. There was another member of this family as well. You may be familiar with that, that's the skunk. The skunk was considered to be a member of this family up until about 5 years ago, and then the latest genetic testing led scientists to conclude that they weren't members of that family. So they were unceremoniously booted out of the family. I hear they made a big stink about it. But it didn't get them anywhere. Thank you. I include this in case nobody laughs in the room, because I can count on a laugh from this guy. Now this one, the story in this picture, to me, it's these teeth. Look at those sharp, jagged teeth. This is not a creature you're going to want to go up to and go, here, kitty, 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 kitty. Now you're not want to get close to an otter anyway, because we need to make sure that we give them their space and don't disturb them. I should point out that all my pictures, even if it looks like I'm right in their face or they're in my face, are taken from a long distance away. I use telephoto lenses. I try to make very sure that I'm not disturbing the otter. I'm not catching its attention in any way. I'm not doing anything to make it deviate from the patterns of activity that it needs to have in order to survive. There we go. It's important to remember that sea otters evolved from land creatures. Somewhere between about 5 and 7 million years ago, you ended up with your Rev Otter 2.0, which is the otter that lives and gives birth in the ocean. And there were a number of adaptations they made in order to do that. They're just like all the other marine mammals in the sense that they came from the land into the ocean. It's just the otters are sort of the most recent. But they had to do some adapting, some little adaptations. Those big flippers, remember, on land, they just had feet, little paws. So they've got these really thick flippers now in order to get through the water. Their lungs expanded in capacity, so they're about 2.5 times bigger than they used to be, so that they can take those deep breaths that they need to take in order to dive down to up to 400 feet deep. But I think there's really two big adaptations that define the relationship between humans and otters, and that's first, that fur that I mentioned. For otters, I call it, it's all about the fur, basically. It's so vital to their survival and to our relationship. In terms of the history. This is a creature that's got the most dense fur of any creature on the planet, right? In 1 square inch on their body, that's about a square inch, they have 500,000 to 1 million hairs. That's pretty dense. We have about 160,000 on our head. I have a few less, I'm losing mine now. But sometimes I think of a sea otter as just a giant marine fur ball. If you look at this picture, sometimes it takes a second to get oriented. She's lying on her back. Her head is up there. Let's see the pointer. There we go. That's her eye. Right? That's her mouth, and that's her arm, her paw. So she's just shaggy fur ball. This is another look at fur, and this one sort of shows, you see how thick it is? You see how it's folded up on the neck of this guy? They've got very loose skin. An otter is kind of like a size 7 otter and a size 10 skin because they need to be able to move it around so that they can groom it and be able to reach their backs and things like that. This is what happens when you cross a polar bear and a sea otter. Seriously, that's not true. This is merely a southern sea otter from the Central California coast, just happens to have a little more blonde in that fur than most. And the sun is hitting it in a way that kind of brings it out. For a sea otter to have that 500,000 to 1,000,000 hairs per square inch, they have to have actually two layers. That's the only way they can get that many in there. They've got a sort of a longer guard hair, that's the outer hair. They've got a shorter under fur. They actually blow bubbles of air and get it trapped in that fur, and they roll around to get air trapped in the fur, so they create an envelope of air around them up against their skin. It takes an envelope of air, it takes the under fur, it takes that longer guard hair, and then they spread some natural oils on their fur. It takes all of that to be able to resist that freezing cold water just because they don't have any blubber. But for the pups, even that's not enough. This is a pup riding on top of his mom, staying out of the water. Zooming in on the pup, you see that shaggy fur around the neck? That doesn't look exactly like what you think an otter would look like. It's a little longer, shaggier fur. You can also see how the water is beating up on the back. It's just coming and rolling right off the back. And this is because for the first couple of months of their life, they need to have a special fur that keeps them alive in the water because they can't swim. Otherwise, they would drown like a hot rock if they didn't have a life jacket on. And that pup fur is their life jacket. It actually just creates so much buoyancy that they can't sink. And it's kind of comical to watch an otter try to dive at this stage and just bounce right back up because they can't go under with a life jacket. And here's a video clip of just that. He really wants to dive. He'd love to follow mom down. She goes down so smoothly. And he's wearing a life jacket. Now, I said it's all about the fur, but there may be a few other factors involved. The other big change, I said there were two, is they developed this incredibly high metabolism. They burn hot, and they have to eat a lot in order to support that. They burn a lot of calories, again, for their warmth. So it might even be that for sea otters, it's all about the food. A sea otter has to eat typically about 25 to 30% of its body weight each day to survive. That would be like me eating 40 or 50 pounds of food a day. They're doing it one clam at a time, right? It's a tough job. It means that they spend somewhere between 8 hours and maybe as many as 14 hours a day involved in hunting and eating, depending on their habitat. Little otter, big clam. This was from 2 days ago, actually. Just took this picture. This pup is really trying to get into it. This is not a clam, this is a mussel. And the story for this picture, to me, is those teeth once again. Notice how sharp they are. Notice how thick and conical shaped they are, right? So that they can crush, if they're strong, they crush through those shells and they scrape the food out. When you think about a shark's tooth, what shape comes to mind? Sort of triangular, razor sharp and triangular. So they're very different. The shark's tooth is designed to rip flesh off. This is designed to crush, so it's much more powerful. It's a crab eater. You've seen these pictures, you've seen clams, mussels, crab now. And the sea otters tend to specialize in one type of shellfish or another, or at least a few types, that's sort of passed on from the mom to the pup, that tendency, that favorite. The moms do pass along a lot of things. They teach them how to swim, they teach them how to hunt, they teach them what to eat, essentially. But the reason that they specialize is because becoming more expert at one type of shellfish means that you're going to get more efficient. You're a better machine at getting those calories or getting that nutritional value and expending fewer calories. So there's a reason for that specialization. Doesn't mean they're going to starve to death if they don't have that particular thing that they like. They will eat anything. But if they have a choice, they'll do what they like. This is a more disturbing picture of a crab. This picture bothers me because this is a glass jar and a crab. The otter came up with both. And so it's a glass jar that someone thoughtlessly threw into the ocean. Now it's in the hands of an otter, and the chances are pretty decent that it's going to break. Now, if it breaks, what's going to happen? If it cuts that fur or cuts the skin, then that otter, remember that great insulation, that's going to be ruined, and that otter may die from exposure to the ocean. If it cuts its paw or it cuts its mouth or any way in which it's going to not be able to manipulate food or catch food or eat food, then it's going to face a real dilemma. It'll lose about 10 pounds a day if an otter can't eat, and it can only lose about 25 pounds before it's going to die. So these creatures really don't have any margin for safety. There's no buffer for these guys. And just that kind of trash can lead to that kind of a problem. And that's not the only incident of trash. I've got a lot of other trash photos, believe it or not. This is an otter pup who came up from the bottom of the ocean with a piece of canvas that somebody threw away. He is twisted up in it, and every time he tries to figure out how to get out of it, he gets more twisted up in it. And remember I said I'd take my pictures from a distance away, so I'm probably 50 yards away on the shoreline watching this situation unfold. It's another type of prey. If you look closely, you see the tentacles of the octopus there. And I thought I should mention just a couple of words about the mechanics. We know that they go down, they get that shellfish, they bring up a rock along with it so that they can put the rock on their chest and they can crack the shellfish open, right? Well, they don't always want to have to get a new rock every time, because that's like getting two things every single dive. So if they find a rock that they like, they can carry that rock around with them, and that's what's going on here. She's got a little rock tucked away under this very loose flap of skin under her arm, and she's got a rock tucked in there. Don't believe me? I asked her to show us. Now this otter, I consider she's the queen. Because she came up one day, she had this lovely seaweed crown, which I thought was kind of nice. But once again, I asked the question, what's up with the paws? What's going on in this picture? This is an otter who's very clever. She's figured out, why should I go and get a rock every time, or even carry a rock around with me? There are plenty of rocks on the shoreline. Why don't I just take my clam over to the shoreline and I'll just crack it open there? So she's actually got new ways of using tools. You know, she's on to something. And here's a video clip of her doing her thing. Otter yoga. I like to stop on this picture so that I can take a deep breath and settle down for the more dark topic that we will talk about now. These other things have been light and fun compared to the fur trade, which is when the otters were driven literally to the edge of extinction. And some have called it California's first gold rush because it predated the gold rush and it created the same kind of commercial frenzy. And the value of the pelts rivaled that of gold. To try to put a little perspective on it, there we go. I try to put my mind in the mindset of a fur trader or a fur hunter in the 1700s and 1800s, because we think about things a little differently today. And then I try to look at this and go, okay, when she's in the water, she's kind of just, you know, a little shaggy and what have you. But when she's out of the water, she's about four times as big as she is in the water. And you can really see that thickness of that pelt. And maybe you can see a glimmer of, oh, commercial value maybe here. And then, of course, I think now if you see a small group of them out on land, again, as a fur trader, you could really start to see there is some potential value there. And you can see how maybe that got its start. By the way, these are out of the water. You're not going to likely see otters out of the water like this. They're not like seals and sea lions. They don't come out and pile up on the beach. The reason that you won't see that very often is because they will always go to a very secluded location. They're very vulnerable, so they're going to find places that aren't likely to be spotted by anybody. They're really good in the water. They're very agile, but when they're out on land, they're extremely clumsy, and so they're totally vulnerable. But by this one, to me, then you can sort of connect the dots. This guy is sort of the king of the fur to me, and you can see how you get from him to this. Now, in the early 1700s, the range of the sea otter was from the coast of Japan all the way around the northern Pacific Rim to Baja California. That's how extensive it was. And the Russians began the fur trade, trading with the Chinese. And they began to hunt them up the Japanese coast. And this was not a sustainable hunt. This was taking all the creatures. It was taking the pups and the moms as well as the adult males, and there were no limitations on them. So, you know, you can't do that to a species for very long, which is why they had to continue along the coastline. By about 1740, they crossed over to Alaska. This was Captain Vitus Bering, the Bering Strait now bears his name, right? And that was an otter fur trading expedition, basically, over to Alaska. And by the 1770s, joined by the Americans and some of a couple of other European countries. And on down the coast they came. And by the early 1800s, there were ships that were taking 3,000 otter pelts per voyage, 4,000 otter pelts per voyage, and once again, really destroying that population. And finally, by 1911, having completely cleared the Pacific Rim of more than a million sea otters, they were widely believed to be extinct, none left whatsoever. As it turns out, miraculously and luckily, there was a little group of about 40 sea otters that survived off the coast of Big Sur. And actually, it's from that little group of 40 that today's 3,000 otters have come. 3,054 is the most recent census that was released last fall. There's another census being calculated right now. The northern populations, I'm not focused on them, they have recovered better. That is, there has been a more robust recovery in each of those other subspecies, although there are still problems, they're still at risk, and in the Alaskan populations, there are still some pockets that are having some significant troubles. But our 3,000, one that I'm talking about tonight, and the latest research is beginning to demonstrate that there seems to be maybe a carrying capacity issue, that we've reached 3,000, it's maybe not going to go up much above that, unless the otters can expand the range in which they live. The range right now is from about halfway between San Francisco and Monterey, up where I'm from, down to something south of Gaviota or thereabouts, moving southward slowly. But that's the range, and unless they can expand that range, that number's not going to get much above 3,000. So they need to come south. It would be nice if they would go north. That was, of course, their original range all the way across, but it seems to be more difficult. They're moving much more slowly in the northerly direction, so they got to come south. This is about how many sea otters we had in 1911. Pretty small group, pretty vulnerable, pretty amazing. And when we have such a small number, and even 3,000 is a pretty small number after 100 years, you have to start thinking about, well, what can go wrong? What kind of threats could take them out? And of course, oil spills become, you know, a very, very important risk factor. And in fact, we transport so much oil up and down the coast. All the Alaskan oil that's transported by a tanker comes down the coast, either to San Francisco or down here for refining. So we have an active threat out there. And so when you have that kind of threat, you start to ask a question, what can we do? What can we do to try to prevent a disaster? Or another disaster, I guess, in this case. And so, we'll get to the law. In 1985, what was done was Congress created a program called the Sea Otter Translocation Program. And under that program, 140 sea otters were taken from Central California coast and flown down here to, or not quite to here, but to San Nicolas Island and put in the waters around San Nicolas Island, which is one of the channel islands up near Santa Barbara, one of the northern channel islands. And the idea was to create a backup colony, so that if a disaster took out the otters along the Central California coast, there'd be something to work with. But, as sometimes happens, there were some trade-offs made to create this program politically. And the shellfish industry in Southern California had concerns that bringing otters down to where they hadn't been for 100 years might threaten the shellfish industry. So what was also done with this program was to create something called the No Otter Zone, the No Otter Zone. And the best way I can describe the no otter zone is to put a map up of California, show you the habitat or the range of the sea otters, and this is the no otter zone. So basically, from Point Conception to the Mexican border, other than around San Nicolas Island, one little dot, otters were to be removed if they happened to stray into the Southern California waters. And they were to either be taken back to San Nicolas Island or back to the Central California coast. And I know you might be scratching your heads going, boy, that sure seems like an odd thing to do, to have a program that's designed to prevent otters from being extinct, to have this as an element. But I can't explain the law, I can just share it with you. No, there's one worse element than that also was included. which is that the Endangered Species Act protections for sea otters, which had been in place since 1977, were suspended or lifted in the no-otter zone. Now, this program, strange as its design was, failed, but it failed for reasons other than this. After the first 3 years, more than 80% of those otters that were brought down actually disappeared, were killed, died, or swam back to the Central California coast. And that last thing, swimming back to the Central California coast, is somewhat remarkable. Remember I said they were flown down? And they weren't dropping breadcrumbs. They don't have GPS. They're not homing pigeons. And typically a sea otter lives out its life within about 4 miles of where it's born. So how they made it back several hundred miles to the Central California coast is still a mystery. But nonetheless, the program failed. Well, it took till a few years ago before the Fish and Wildlife Service finally went ahead and terminated the program officially. And they restored the Endangered Species Act protections. And they ended the no-otter zone. And that triggered the litigation that I mentioned. The shell fisheries in Southern California filed some lawsuits, two of them. And what they were seeking to do was to restore the no-otter zone and to restore the no-penalty zone. And the courts, in two different federal cases last year, two different judges basically went ahead and denied those requests for different reasons. And one of the judges wrote in his opinion some language that I just want to share. Said plaintiff's interpretation of the law would lead to an absurd result. And what John Walter was talking about was the absurd result that would be if the Fish and Wildlife Service, on the one hand, was responsible for doing whatever it could to promote the survival of the species, and on the other hand, was responsible for removing them from the waters, which were exactly the place that they needed to go in order to be able to survive as a species. So Judge Walter got it, figured that out, and determined that that was not the right position to have the Fish and Wildlife Service in. Is that the end of the story? No, of course not. Both cases have been appealed. Both are up on appeal right now in the federal courts. Actually, some action in the second of those cases just a couple of weeks ago, but we don't know what's going to happen. The story's not done. We're waiting for further rulings from the courts. So when I look at that and I step back and I go, the law really didn't work very well in terms of this situation. Got kind of twisted up, turned very quickly from a shield for sea otters into a sword. And so maybe this story is more about, at a simple level, the otters need to repopulate. That's done one pup at a time. And maybe for the sea otters then, it's all about the kids. And raising a sea otter pup is a labor of love. It's extremely taxing on the moms. There's really no help from the dads. In fact, they can be interventionist in a bad way. It's a 24-hour job. It's exhausting. Imagine eating 30% of your body weight, and then they have to eat on top of that for the pup. I mean, it's really tough stuff. I actually saw that in person. When I followed this mom and this pup, I was actually able to follow them for about 5 months. They're not tagged, so it wasn't that easy, but I did stick with them. And I saw this. I saw how taxing it is. I saw how much that mom is constantly tending to the pup one way or the other. And in fact, they've identified end lactation mortality syndrome, which is basically they've found that some of the otter moms are dying after they've weaned the pup because it's just drained and depleted their resources so much. So, not an easy job. But I told you at the outset, or I showed you this picture of this little guy, and I didn't tell you what he was up to, so now I want to reveal him in action. So I'll use a video clip to do that. If you're not familiar enough with the otter anatomy to know, so I'll give it away. He's nursing. And this is something that you're not going to see in the wild very often. It's extremely rare. I felt very, very lucky to have been able to witness it and also to be able to capture it. This is another form of nutritional assistance. Sometimes if it's the middle of the day and I'm hungry, that muscle actually looks pretty good. And this is a little bit of otter socialization. It's the beginning of an otter play date. These are two moms and two pups, and they're paired up. The moms are on the outside there. They've each got a hold of their pup, and what they've done is they've come together, There's not a lot of rolling around and playing and interaction like that. There's just this little instance of physical touching. And then they go off to their respective quarters. But as they're getting started in their lives together, our evening is going to be coming to an end, and so I need to start sharing with you some final thoughts about threats, and stewardship, and celebration of the ocean. When it comes to threats, remember I said that we share some of the same threats as the otters. And the laundry list is basically contaminated runoff. They live in those nearshore ocean waters, so they're affected by all the things that we put into the water. Pollution, we've talked a little bit about oil, talked a little bit about trash. We know about plastics. We know there's a lot of issues with regard to the ocean in terms of pollution. Competition for food, remember, they eat what we eat. We eat what they eat, and in that competition, we have a tendency to win because we cheat. We use heavy industrialized commercial equipment, and they're going at it one clam at a time. Predation may be one threat where we don't necessarily share that, or not all the time, because I'm talking here about great white sharks. Great white sharks are a source of mortality for sea otters, but it's kind of an accident. It's not really intended to be that way. The sharks think they're getting a sea lion or a seal. They'll bite into it. There's no good blubber in there. And they'll basically let the otter out, or they'll spit it out. And the otter's going to die from the wounds. The shark's going to go away hungry. And nobody wins on that encounter. Habitat degradation. We're still doing a lot of development along the shoreline of the California coast, despite the fact we have Coastal Commission. We have lots of restraints and protective mechanisms in place. But nonetheless, we're still doing a lot of development. And when we do that, we affect those nearshore ecosystems at a local level, you know, no matter what we're doing. So if I had more time, we'd go into each of these in a greater depth. I just want to sort of give you the picture. Range limitation, you know, I talked about the need to expand to the south because that population is not going to grow that much otherwise. Climate change is on here, not because it's low on the list of threats. It's down here with an exclamation point because it's really high. It deserves its own session. You have several sessions on that because of the importance. I will just highlight the fact that the increasing acidification at the surface level of the ocean is something that has a very direct effect on the food web, and shellfish in particular, because shellfish are directly affected by the level of acidification. It affects their ability to grow and maintain their shells, and of course the otters' chief source of food is the shellfish, so pretty quickly you get around to a circle that gets to the sea otters. And I put humans on here with a question mark. I know we're part of the threat. The question kind of is how much is a part of the solution are we going to be? Hopefully more rather than less. And so in some ways, I at times think about this struggle as something that is really for the otters, it's more about us. And that brings me to ocean stewardship. This is not an otter, I recognize that. This is a humpback whale from Monterey Bay just a couple of weeks ago. I include that to show that my camera can actually take pictures of other creatures besides sea otters, because some people have doubted that. But I put it in here because this is another pair of humpback whales actually from Monterey Bay. Also, they each have thousands of anchovies in their mouth at this instant when they've come out of the water. Because stewardship to me is all about the ocean, all the creatures in the ocean, and that entire environment. And I know that I'm preaching to the choir to a large extent here. You're all here because you're already somewhere down that path, either partway down or a long way down that path of caring about the ocean, volunteering your efforts, being involved in education, changing your lifestyles to do things that you know, put a lighter footprint out there for the ocean and for the planet as a whole. So I'm just going to highlight one thing that sometimes I think is given short shrift, and that again is the whole notion of legislation or lawmaking, policymaking. It's important to remember that politicians who we elect, you know, are people. They set the agenda in that sense. They make laws. They appoint heads of agencies. Agencies make rules and regulations. They launch programs. They implement programs. They enforce programs. So we need to be thoughtful about who it is that we're putting in positions of leadership, but staying involved in trying to make sure we do that, because it does make a difference, I think, along the way. So What's on the horizon? This is the guy, that mom and that pup that I followed. I wrote a book where I put together a bunch of pictures of them and told the story of a life-altering event that they went through. The book's not published yet, but it has a bunch of pictures, and this is one of them. And I think he's sort of wondering about what's on the horizon, and this is him staring off into space thinking about it. And so I want to wrap up by reading an excerpt from a column that I wrote. I've been writing this column about sea otters for almost 5 years now, I just realized. And this is an excerpt from one from a couple of years ago. After gradually learning more about sea otters, I began to see that they've had the incredible resilience to withstand human impacts that alter the ocean environment. Yet they're particularly vulnerable to these threats precisely because they're dependent on the ocean and all that it brings with it. And in that way, they're quite like humans. I see us in them. And I think that may be the essence of my fascination, because we too are completely dependent on the ocean and our environment for our survival. And our futures are not guaranteed. But I see hope in the long-term survival of both species so long as we remain committed to making the types of changes that are required. And when I see the wonder of sea otters, I imagine future talks 50 years from now, and I hope people will be saying that we were good stewards of the sea and all that depends upon it. And I want to thank you all for coming out tonight. It's been a real privilege to be here.